problems with empiricism, but I think these are more like mosquito bites over against the hammer blows of what Hume was doing here. Okay, so now to appreciate Kant, you can see that the age of reason, why would philosophers call it such a thing? The age of reason ended in subjectivism and skepticism, didn't it? Whether you're a rationalist or an empiricist. And that led to a collapse of confidence in man's intellectual ability and the objectivity of knowledge, particularly the objectivity of knowledge of a real, orderly world. Neither the rationalist nor the empiricist were able to find a reliable method of knowing. And it turns out that there's huge disagreements over this instrument called reason and what reason is supposed to be. You know, it's one thing for the unbelieving world to say, we exalt reason. In the French Revolution, you remember, the goddess of reason was exalted. You know, but if you were an analytical philosopher, you'd say, what are you talking about when you speak of reason? You're talking about reason as Spinoza understood it? Leibniz? Berkeley? Locke? Hume? Who? What is reason in the age of reason? Well, it's a zillion different things. And Kant was scandalized by that.
And you said the age of reason collapsed into what?
Skepticism.
And?
No, subjectivism and skepticism. Does that sound like a familiar tag team?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
You know, you said earlier, talking about continental rationalism, that reality equaled rationality, you know that? Reality is rational.
Yes. And now we have rational men disagreeing with each other about reality.
Right, so it's really it's the particular rationalist determining what reality is.
Yeah, so it's subjective, which reduces to skepticism. And what was, what? Why do they keep having this problem? Because their fundamental assumption is the autonomy of man. They began with man as the reference point and the final authority. In the history, well, in the way philosophy is taught in secular, well, even in Christian schools, but the way philosophy is taught, it's as though, well, to do philosophy, you have to assume that. I mean, that's just, you're not doing philosophy if you don't do that. So when we suggest, well, maybe you ought to begin with a theological presupposition, with God, who is the creator of man, rather than with man who then goes out to discover God. But if you suggest that today, you'll be told, I think almost invariably, you'll be told, you're not doing philosophy, you're doing theology. And we all know how disreputable theology is. Well, I don't wince too much when they say that. I say, yeah, the only thing is, my theology can save your philosophy, so maybe we ought to talk a bit more. Okay, Kant, finally. Kant was scandalized by the situation in philosophy. You have these rationalists and you have these empiricists, and they both reduced to subjectivism and skepticism. In particular, he wrote that he was awakened from his dogmatic slumbers by Hume. And Kant was led to alter the view of reason that he had previously held. That's why the title of his book, his best known book, most important book, I think, is A Critique of Pure Reason. Kant's philosophy is sometimes called critical philosophy. He wrote The Critique of Pure Reason in 1781, which is a very obscure and prolix book, but is still considered his masterpiece. The Critique of Practical Reason in 1788, and then The Critique of Judgment in 1790. And so when you write enough books that have the title critique in it, you get to call your philosophy critical philosophy. Kant was awakened from his dogmatic slumbers, came to a new view of reason. Such a new view of reason that he said it amounted to a Copernican revolution in philosophy. A Copernican revolution. You all know what the Copernican revolution is? Someone fill me in, quick. Rich? What?
Geocentric,
yeah. And so the geocentric view, which had been promoted by, well, but before him, Ptolemy, had dominated until Copernicus, making use of the telescope and other instruments, said we really have to reorient the way we look at things. It's not that the Earth is stationary, let's say passive, and everything is active around it. It's that the Earth is active and is actually going around the stationary object, the Sun. Likewise, Kant said Locke was wrong to think the mind is passive. The mind is active. In order to make sense out of our thoughts, the mind has got to make them sensible. Not only sensible, but intelligible. And how does the mind make them sensible? It always attributes to our always attributes to those sensations coming in, time and space predicates. The mind actively imposes order on the chaos of the world that we encounter. Of course, I'm assuming it's a world out there. Basically, Kant said, there are things in themselves and we know nothing about them. We don't know the way things are as they really are in and of themselves. We only know them as we experience them. But as we experience them, we impose temporal and spatial characteristics. We impose order on our sensations. Not only do we make our sensations sensible, part of time and space, but we also make them intelligible because we have to categorize them. Our sensations have to be formed as things that are understood causally, substantially, numerically, and so forth. So Kant goes through in the critique an argument for all these different categories in terms of which we must think. Hume had gotten rid of causation in inductive reasoning, saying we don't ever observe it. If our minds are passive and we only know what impinges on our minds, causation's never impinged on our mind because nothing necessary, well, to put it simply, nothing necessary can be particular and we only sense particular things. So we can't ever have a sensation of causation or of substance. Kant said, oh, and Hume's final word is, that's just the habit of the mind. Kant says, I can save science. I can save causation. I can save substance. Oh, how's that? Kant says, it's a habit of the mind. Don't you get it? I mean, I'm not being cutesy here. That's an old philosopher's joke. Basically, Kant took Hume's despairing conclusion and made it the answer to Hume's skepticism. Hume said, the only reason we draw causal connections is because we're in the habit of doing it. It's a mental habit. Of course, he can't account for habits, given his view of man, and so forth. But Kant takes that and says, well, the mind itself imposes actively causal categories and everything. And that's why if you talk about God, you have to, if God's going to be intelligible to us, we have to ask, where does God come from? Now, Kant also had a portion of his critique that he reserved for the categories of God, world, and self. And on these, he said, though we have to think in terms of these other categories of substance and cause, we can't draw conclusions from them. They are only limiting notions. The only God that could be intelligible to us would have to be a God that has a cause, but we know better than to say that. God can't have a cause. So that's just a way of thinking by which we limit all of our causal reasoning and then we stop and we call that God. But we don't really intelligently or intelligibly know God. For Kant, God was part of the noumenal realm. God exists as a thing in itself and we can't know God. We can only know God as he would appear to us, and God would have to appear to us in categories amenable to our way of thinking. Our way of thinking is causal, therefore God can't appear to us in miraculous way. Because for us to think rationally about anything is to reject miracles. Right? Now, this is all very wicked stuff, but it's also extremely entertaining and clever. What's it rest on? Rest on the assumption that we don't know the objective world. We only know the internal phenomenal world, the world as it's experienced by us. And since that world is itself formed, made intelligible by the activity of the mind, then naturally what we think is necessary, and what we think in terms of the categories, is necessary. Necessary by what? Psychological habit. So Kant said, against rationalism, there are no innate ideas. According to him, nothing can be known rationally apart from experience. So he's against the rationalist, he favors the empiricist on this one. There are no innate ideas. The mind doesn't have ideas in it inherently. But against empiricism, the mind is not a tabula rasa. The mind is not passive, it is rather a constructive, active agent. So that what we know is to be attributed not just to the world outside us, but is to be attributed to the activity of the mind in constructing a world that is intelligible to us. And so, to use the famous line for which Kant is known, concepts without percepts are empty, percepts without concepts are blind. If you only have perceptions and they are not made intelligible by the concepts, they're blind. But if you only have concepts, like causation, substance, whatever, without perceptions, then they'll be empty. Kant claimed to save science and to make room for faith in this philosophy. How did he save science? Well, he resurrected the causal principle, the principle of unity between perceptions as a substance, and so forth. That's a strange way of saving science, though, because he saved science by claiming that the objects of knowledge must conform to the knowing process. The objects of knowledge. Don't believe in conspiracies. I mean, okay. So essentially, Kant saves science by subjectivizing it. Science becomes a necessity of our subjective thinking process. I quote Kant again, "The understanding is itself the lawgiver of nature." The understanding itself is the lawgiver of nature. So do we find natural laws? Sure we do. But that's because the understanding imposes those laws. Kant was, accordingly, a metaphysical agnostic. He didn't know reality. And yet, he held to the certainty of the knowing process, and he did so by subjectivizing it. Now, what did we say earlier when philosophies are reduced to subjectivism? Yeah. Essentially, Kant, for all of his transcendental... thought, for what he was attempting to do, Kant himself succumbs to skepticism as well. If nothing else, Kant doesn't ever get beyond what's called the egocentric predicament. Because if Kant is right about how his mind must think in a certain way, Kant doesn't show us that all minds must think in that way. He thought he did, but he didn't. Much more, he did not show that if all minds must think this way, that the objects outside the mind must be like that. Kant called his position transcendental idealism. And the reason he used that language is that he said, a transcendental is what is presupposed by experience in order for it to be experience. Or, I think it's easier to say, it's what's presupposed for an experience to be intelligible. experience is automatically intelligible for Kant because experience is formed by the mind. Okay, so outside of Kantian thinking, we would say an experience, let's say some kind of input to our senses, is intelligible on certain presuppositions. And those presuppositions are the transcendentals. Transcendental analysis thus asks, what are the preconditions for the intelligibility of human experience? Or under what conditions is it possible to make sense of the world or to experience, rationally to experience the world? Why don't we just stop our Christian apologetical search with Kant then? I mean, he was so smart to get onto this transcendental approach. Why aren't we satisfied with Kant's transcendental analysis? Well, I've already indicated to you, well, Kant's transcendental analysis is subjective. It doesn't really give us any metaphysical information. Kant's transcendental analysis is psychological and assumes, without any warrant, the universal psychological operations of men.
How did he think he proved that?
How did he think he proved what?
That all our minds are going to work the same in that respect.
Well, interpreters will differ with you as to how Kant would answer that. Basically, Kant said, you're not talking about thinking if they don't do what I'm telling you. Now, well, okay. But now, is that a linguistic convention? Is that what he was getting at? Or was he trying to objectify psychological processes without any metaphysical bridge? I mean, it's questionable, you know, how Kant would have gotten out of the dilemma. But Kant himself thought that in the nature of the case, that's what thinking is. I mean, he thought he was analyzing thinking per se. It's a critique of pure reason. And so if you're going to talk about reason, you're talking about what I'm talking about. I know that's frustrating. Part of being able to get a PhD in philosophy is to endure a lot of frustration. It comes down to this, how do you interpret that reply? Is Kant saying we're not using terms in the same way, so we don't have the same conceptual scheme? Is he a cultural relativist? Well, probably not. But on the other hand, he wasn't trying to make some kind of empirical psychological observation for which he didn't have sufficient evidence. So I don't know. Any Kantians, any Kant scholars out there want to offer anything better? Mike? No? Well,
because, you know, Hume is saying causation is a habit of the mind. And Kant's coming later, though, that ruins science, but I'll say that it's a habit of the mind. But the fact that everyone seems to have the same habit of the mind, does he feel a need to explain that?
Now, I think that's one of his unexamined assumptions. And so, although this is supposed to be a critique, when you come clean down to your underwear intellectually, Kant left some things unexamined.
I mean, he did say, I mean, he tried to justify it with transcendental arguments, showing that these concepts are necessary preconditions for our experience and the way we view the world. And from that, I think implicit in his whole discussion is there's no other way of conceiving of the world. You can't conceive of the world without causation. I mean, that's intertwined with his arguments and deduction, that you have to view the world through the prism of causation. You have to view the world through the prism of substance. We can't make the world conceptual scheme intelligible without those types of things. So to him, I mean, it's just like Dr. Munson's definition, that's what thinking is, that to not have that type of stuff in your conceptual scheme is not to have, he didn't use conceptual scheme language, mind you, but to not have those things in your conceptual scheme and not to have one at all. And not to have one at all is not to be able to think.
Yeah. According to Kant, reality could not be understood by a single, unified, common set of principles. To understand nature, you have to use causal principles. Now, I have not talked about this next thing, but I'm just putting it out there for you. But to understand morality and human personality, you have to use principles of freedom. And so according to him, even on his own approach, there are two wonders, the starry heavens above and the moral law within, and you can't bring them together. And that's poetic language. But what he says, the way you understand the physical cosmos will not help you understand the moral law. And the way you understand the moral law, freedom, will not help you understand the physical cosmos. Physical cosmos is governed by causation, determinism. Okay? But morality presupposes freedom, indeterminism. And Kant admitted that and left it out there. So does he have a unified worldview? No, he doesn't have one at all. So I don't think his transcendental arguments save science, as he thought, because they really succumb to subjectivism. And he doesn't save philosophy in general because he doesn't have a common principle by which you can account for things or give explanation. There's two kinds of explanations, and he never can bring them together. And then one more comment about Kant, just so you'll understand why us Vantillians like what he was trying to do but don't like the way he did it. Did Kant save human personality, the unity of the person? Hume said, I'm only a bundle of perceptions. And twice I've now indicated or more, he doesn't even have the right to say bundle, because bundle assumes unity, and he doesn't see any unity there. But anyway, he knew there was no connection on his philosophy between the perceptions, so there couldn't be any person to have the experience. Now, Kant realizes that's devastating, and that destroys the ability to know anything. And so Kant argues that there must be a unity of thinking, a subject who thinks. But according to him, that subject cannot be known observationally, obviously. By the way, having mirrors doesn't help this problem, because you're not you may observe a physical body in the mirror, but you're not observing, to use Descartes' language, the mind that experiences and unites all of those experiences. Kant says you do have to have a subject of thinking, but that subject of thinking cannot be known observationally. The subject of thinking can only be known through its thinking. That is, we only know ourselves in the act of knowing. And in that case, in knowing myself, Kant says, I only know a place, I'm using my language, a place marker. The human person is diaphanous. When I look at myself, not my body, but when I look at myself as a knower, I'm really looking through me. Because the only me there is this place marker for all of these experiences that are coming in. So we don't find that an adequate apologetic, to be real obvious. God cannot be known because God is in the noumenal realm. Any God that you could rationally know would have to be subject to scientific determinism, no miracles, etc., etc. The only God that you could know would be a God that stands behind the moral law as a limiting notion that there'll be a day of judgment if we don't live up to the rational moral law within us. But that moral law can't be related to the world that we know rationally about us either. So he has a dichotomy in his philosophy. And then finally, we don't even know ourselves, except as there's a philosophical necessity for something to unite apperception. Kant's word was, there's a transcendental unity of apperception. We must think of ourselves as having perceptions. It's a transcendental necessity. But that unity is diaphanous. It doesn't have any content, any detail. It's essentially a function, a place marker in our thinking. The expression,
that
I don't think Kant was real proud of that in the sense that he had come up with something grand. I think he would just say that's the way it is. The point is, with that, I can save rationality. Okay, having introduced Kant in his context, let me bring you up to date now and put transcendental arguments in the context of modern philosophical argument. I have a little chart here that I've worked out so you'll have some appreciation and understanding of what's distinctive about the transcendental approach. In the case of Kant, we see that the transcendental approach is distinct because he's not looking for observations to justify his philosophy. He's not an empiricist. But nor is he trying to look for clear and distinct ideas from which he can deduce the nature of reality. He's not a rationalist. He's not doing the rational game, the empiricist game. He's asking, what else must be true in order to make sense out of my thinking as a scientist, my thinking as a logician, or whatever it may be? He's asking for the presuppositions of the intelligibility of any experience whatsoever. Now, in modern epistemology, you can think of the strategies in the theory of knowledge as being responses, various responses to skepticism. The reason why we need a theory of knowledge is because there are skeptics, basically. It's possible to ask skeptical questions about what we know. Now, when we answer questions on how we know what we know, we get pushed back to assumptions that we've been using. And then the skeptic is going to say, how do you know about those assumptions? And then that may push you back further. But eventually, we reach, in every school of philosophy, what will be called fundamental assumptions. Can your fundamental assumptions be justified? Can they be rationally justified? And in the literature, this sometimes is put in this form, can rationality be justified? Because you've been trying to show the skeptic, here's how I know what I know, and you've gone through various levels of assumptions. You get down to the bottom, can this rational procedure that you've been using itself be justified? And the answer of the skeptic is no. Fundamental assumptions cannot be rationally justified, and therefore all belief systems are ultimately arbitrary. Because the standards of justification also need justification if you're going to be rational, you'll either have an infinite regress of justifications or you'll reach some level of commitment that is not rational. So that's the horns of the dilemma. The skeptic's argument is you're either going to have an infinite regress, rational justification with another rational justification behind it, and then another rational justification, and that's going to go on and on and on, in which case nothing ever gets rationally justified, or you're going to stop your appeal to rational justifications and you're going to have a commitment that's not rational. And therefore, rationality itself is not justified. Now, if the skeptic cannot be answered, then we've given way to intellectual anarchy or dogmatism. Anarchy says everything's relative, no one can know for sure, and everyone has the right to believe what they believe and therefore to do what they want to do. And this is where we cross the fine line between academic or intellectual sophistication and the playing out of worldviews. Students who are anarchist in their view of literature, philosophy, ethics don't tend to live lives that are not anarchistic, where every man's a law unto himself. Dogmatism, we already talked about earlier, is the view that you just come down to power plays. You have usually institutional restraints on what can be said or believed or lived out. So you have skepticism needing an answer if we're going to save rationality. And the attempts to meet the skeptical challenge can be divided into three on my outline, and then there's going to be some subdivisions. First of all, there's the foundationalist attempt. Foundationalism unites together various epistemologies which want to eliminate arbitrariness in our thinking, want to eliminate prejudice, relativism, unwarranted conjecture, and attempt to obtain cognitive certainty that's not just a kind of psychological assurance. And the way in which we get cognitive certainty, according to foundationalist epistemologies, is to anchor our beliefs in some kind of a foundation of propositions which are themselves unassailable. And then from that foundation, we conduct intellectual inquiries according to some strict rules of reliable method for reasoning. And we don't admit into our belief system any proposition that hasn't been certified by its connection to the foundation or other foundationally certified beliefs. And in that way, we can guarantee ourselves an accurate depiction of the world. We've used the term you may not be familiar with in calling this foundationalism, but you're all familiar with this way of thinking. I think this is pretty much the naive approach to epistemology most everybody takes. It's like, if I know this, then this is founded on this, and this is founded on that, and eventually I get down to the foundation for all of these beliefs. And they're built up by some kind of strict method. We may not agree on what that method is, but first we have foundations, then we have reliable method, and we can be assured the skeptic is wrong. We have an accurate depiction of the world. And the foundationalist that I want you to get into your outline, the most important kinds of foundationalism are conceptual or logical, perceptual, and then finally, common sense foundations. A logical foundationalist holds that the standards by which we judge everything are the rules of logic. Now, unfortunately, the rules of logic are purely formal. And so if that's the only foundation you have, the only knowledge you can get is knowledge which is going to be formalized. It's going to be consistent, but it won't have any details from experience, anything that we know about the world. Perceptual foundationalism holds in one form or another, this is the more empirical approach, that ultimately everything we know needs to be traced back to some kind of perception, the perception thought to be infallible. Of course, that's not accurate. Our perceptions are not infallible. Our perceptions are at best incorrigible. Maybe I can't deny the way I see things, but I can't argue that the way I see things is the way they actually are. And so perceptual foundationalism hits the rocks pretty hard. I mean, the naive empirical approach to epistemology hasn't fared real well, and even its modern advocates, the logical positivist and others, have reduced themselves to self-contradiction and the inability to talk about their own philosophy. And so you can understand the sympathy that many people have then for common sense foundationalism. The common sense approach can be divided into two different ways of seeing common sense. One says it makes no sense to question the rationality of our standards of rationality. Since we accept these as the standards of rationality by common sense, it makes no sense to now question them. The more popular version of common sense philosophy, however, has been conventionalism, usually linguistic conventionalism. The standards that we call commonsensical are part of a form of life with which, in terms of which, we've grown up, learned to use language, and so forth. Well, common sense, you don't have to be a sophisticated student of philosophy to see through that. You know, one man's common sense is another man's absurdity, isn't it? And when you run into people who don't accept what you call common sense, as I said earlier, Wittgenstein said all you can do is yell heretic. At least, and I like Wittgenstein in that, I mean, he knew what he was getting at there. He said, there's no reasoning between these things. These are forms of life. What could I say to somebody who believes something as absurd as that? All I could say is, you're a heretic. I can't reason with you. I can just dogmatically dismiss you. That's nonsense to talk that way. Okay. Foundationalism hasn't fared well. It's not very popular in our days. There are some people who defend it in the common sense and perceptual forms, but not many.
Who are they?
Well, I'll give you a list of them. Actually, if you want to get my article, what's the title of it? No, it's the one on the nature of science and whether science is objective and invariant. Say it again.
Science, subjectivity, and presuppositionalism.
You were right. It had three words in it. I'm sorry, Bill. Science, subjectivity, and presuppositionalism. And I give a list of some of the major players in epistemology today, okay?
This is also
Sellers is the one that I know best, perceptual foundationalism, defending it today. And you have G.E. Moore and Wittgenstein in terms of common sense or linguistic conventionalism and so forth.
But Christians like this instead of eventually.
Oh, yes. And Alston's a good philosopher in terms of knowing his stuff. I don't have to agree with him to, you know, honor his ability. But among evangelical apologists, most tend to be foundationalists. And you'll have Gordon Clark, who early in his career was a logical foundationalist. Coherence is the test. And then you have the evidentialists like Montgomery and others who are empirically, or they would be perceptual. I say that because ultimately that's what it has to be. But the problem is I'm not sure they've thought enough through their theory of knowledge to even know where they fit on the scale here. I mean, maybe I'm being too insulting. I don't mean to be. But, yeah, they eventually are perceptual foundationalists. They believe that observation is the basis for what we know.
They'll point to historical archaeology and stuff like that.
Right. What we've learned through science. And that leads me to the next way to deal with skepticism, and that's pragmatism. And I'm grouping together, in my way of cutting the cake, this may not be the best way, but it helps me. I'm grouping together under pragmatism two different ways of dealing. They're related, but they are distinct as well. Two ways of dealing with the skeptical challenge. The first one says we deal with skepticism by referring in some way, in some normative way, to the model of science. The logic of scientific inquiry becomes the paradigm of rationality. And the reason why the skeptic ought to accede to this model of rationality is that it's the most potentially true and potentially successful way to organize our lives intellectually. So when we study science, I mean, all of us are awed by science, right? Look at its accomplishments. Look at its intellectual restraints, so forth. And so the logic of scientific inquiry is the paradigm of rationality. Now, the difficulty with this is that regardless of what you think of science and its accomplishments, the presuppositions of science must first be defended before science itself is a rational answer to the skeptic. And the general organizing principles of experience, that is the way in which all of our experience is organized, interpreted, and made intelligible, those principles are not appraised by experience itself. And so science, resting on experience and observation, is itself assuming some organizing principles that cannot be scientifically verified or made sense of. They are not themselves appraised by experience. Moreover, whenever you start talking about the model of science, you're going to be embarrassed by two things. First, there have been plenty of cultures, both simultaneous to our own and previous to our own, that did not follow what we call scientific procedure, but we would call them rational people. To say that what we do today in the natural sciences is the model of science assumes that everybody who did things in a way different than we do them now was irrational. They were irrational. And that's, of course, that's nothing more but cultural prejudice talk that way. And so what is it that we have in common with those previous cultures that were rational but didn't do things in the way that we organized them scientifically at the university? And the other thing, and this is the scandal, I think, of those who try to answer the skeptic by the model of science, is there is no model of science. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is what high school students get, and even, as you say, at the college level, introductory books of science. And that's because the winners in the scientific revolution write the textbooks, and they impose them politically, by the way. I mean that literally, as to what can and cannot be said and so forth. But the more you study science, its history, and also its present operation, in the first place, there's no agreement within a narrow field of science. If there were, you wouldn't have the O.J. Simpson trial with all the experts, you know, competing with each other. And you know what the judge has to do there? Notice this. This is fascinating. He has to decide who is scientifically credible. And I'm not putting Judge Ito down. Does Judge Ito have the standards of rationality to decide who's really doing genuine science and who's engaged in quackery? That's a scary thing, isn't it? And that's what happens if you say the model of science. I mean, whose model of science? And it's worse than this, though. It's not just that you have different and competing schools of science within a narrow domain. You don't have one scientific procedure used by all the sciences. That is extremely naive to say. As Gilbert Ryle once said, there's no one science. There are many sciences, all of which are rational. But, it's hard to say, to use a Wittgensteinian phrase, you'd have to say, at best, what makes each of them rational is some kind of family resemblance. But there's no one thing, there's no standard move in argumentation among all the sciences. And so you look at the way a particular domain in science reasons, what kinds of backings for argument, what kinds of warrants are used, what argument forms are followed, and they are not the same as what you find in another science. And so psychologists and physicists and astronomers and historians are all doing science, and they're all trying to be rational, but they don't use a common method. So there are many sciences. The other pragmatic answer to the skeptic, apart from the model of science approach, is the appeal to the success of science or the fruitfulness of science. We can't answer the skeptic ultimately, but we can point to the fruitfulness of science as attaining its goals. Okay. Now the question that has to be asked, though, if you're a skeptic or just trying to be an honest philosopher, is, are the goals of science rational? The problem didn't go away, it just got rephrased. Are the ultimate assumptions of science rational? Can rationality itself be justified? The pragmatist says, well, it's certainly fruitful. I say, okay, but is your fruitfulness rational? Well, it achieves its ends. We're very effective at reaching our goals. Okay, which goal should we be pursuing? Please don't think that that's an easy thing to answer. Among the pragmatists in our day, there's all kinds of differences of opinion. Are we supposed to preserve the species? Is that what it is that makes us rational?
In other words, arbitrary at that point.
It's arbitrary because they're choosing the consequence that they want to achieve. But what should we achieve? Should it be an economic consequence, as Marxists say? Should it be something having to do with the environment? Should it be social egalitarianism? I mean, there's all sorts of things people are striving for. What's that?
Consideration.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Some. They aren't usually, warmly welcomed among the pragmatists, but that would be another one. Pragmatism assumes that we know what is the one rational end we should be achieving. Well, they have no justification for that. There are rivals to the idea of adjusting to our environment or saving the species or bringing social, equality in terms of what we should be pragmatically pursuing. Well, we're getting to the end of our day, probably to the end of our ability to think anymore. What are we going to do if the foundationalist and the pragmatist are not able to answer the skeptic? Well, there's one more form of reasoning, and this is getting back to what Immanuel Kant introduced to us in terms of a procedure or a way of approaching it. He didn't successfully do it, I don't think. But the third way in which the skeptic can be met is to offer a transcendental argument. And the transcendental argument takes the form of saying that we know something is true from the impossibility of the contrary. That's one way of putting it. Or what we're looking for is the precondition for the intelligibility of experience. We say there are certain things we know to be true because those things are the precondition or the presupposition for intelligibility. So now the skeptic can keep blathering all he wants, but our point is, as long as you want to argue, Mr. Skeptic, you're presupposing the intelligibility of what you're saying. And so you've been met on your own ground, and it turns out you can't pursue your skeptical argument without this metaphysic or worldview in terms of which your language, your argument can make sense. Okay? Hopefully this gives you something of a map for the landscape of modern epistemology. It doesn't tell you everything by any means, but the big hills should be easy to see. You have the skeptic, who is really the troublemaker among us all, and the skeptic is going to be answered either in a foundationalist, pragmatic, or transcendental fashion. How does this apply to my opening statement this morning? I believe there's an objective proof for God's existence. Well, we have skeptics out there, religious skeptics and other kinds, right? They say, we can't know these things. Some Christians say, let's try to satisfy the skeptic with foundational answers. Others are willing to say Christianity works the best, and this is really the model for how to live your life. Yet others will say we can meet the skeptic by saying that even your argument presupposes the truth of what we believe, because without what we believe, your argument wouldn't be intelligible. That's the strength of the transcendental approach. When we regather in the morning, I'm going to ask Mike Butler to take our morning session, and if you need some more time, a little more after, but at least our morning session, and go over modern transcendental arguments and what are some of the issues that are involved there. So tonight, if you wish to prepare for that, make sure you look at the, everybody received in the mail, I think, an encyclopedia entry on transcendental arguments. And I know it's not the easiest reading, but go back and read Kant. You were also sent that material. Go slow. That's very well written. I thought that was very helpful. And then the material on transcendental arguments, so you'll be able to enter into Mike's discussion. Thanks a lot.